Can I just say, first of all, Justine Hammer looks great.
She looks so good. I couldn't believe it.
She has never looked this hot ever. I was wowed.
X-Men.
In the 21st century, evil mutants led by Magneto aim to destroy the world. The only hope is X-Men.
Welcome to Cerebro, the X-Men podcast where a homo and his friends dig deep into the history of Homo Superior. I'm your host, Connor Goldsmith, and today for an Avengers podcast is friend of the pod who was just on the show, but we just had to do it to him again, Spencer Ackerman, writer of The New Run on Iron Man, which launched this week as we're recording. We're recording like 2 days after it came out. One day.
It's
Thursday, right? Okay.
Yeah.
I read the review copy on Monday, but then I realized the whole world only just read it yesterday. And so far, I gotta say, apart from that one comment I sent you because it was funny.
It was very funny.
Everything I've seen has been incredibly positive.
Yeah, I didn't expect that.
Well, that's dumb, Spencer, because you wrote a really good fucking comment.
But you also know how we all, let's be real though, we all know how comic fans can be, especially when...
Oh no, I, listen.
Yeah.
You think I'd be looking up what people were saying about anything I wrote? My God, no, I only looked at all because the report seemed so glowing that I was like, surely it'll be safe. And the second I saw that one mean comment I sent you because we agreed it was funny, I was like, tab closed. I don't need to see this anymore. Overall, it seems like you have united many disparate corners of Iron Mandom. That's the Iron Man fandom. I just made that up. For the Iron Man heads who might be listening to this, who don't normally listen to my show, just a brief caveat. I don't really know any fucking thing about Iron Man. I've read I've read Demon in a Bottle. I've read some classic stuff. I've read some of The Fraction. I read Jerry's run recently. Mm-hmm. I really liked how this picked up from that, but then pivoted into something very Spencer. My general experience of Tony Stark outside of the movies, there was a cartoon in the 90s that I watched that in my mind was the Julia Carpenter Spider-Woman cartoon, but they called it Iron Man for some reason, and he was in every episode. They were love interests in that. It was crazy. It was like based on Force Works. I don't know. The 90s were a wild time.
I have read a whole lot of the contemporary with Forceworks Iron Man, the Len Kaminsky era. In those books, they are trying so hard. Like, you can see Marvel thinks... This is also, like, 1992, right? Like, this is
early
like,
90s.
Image comics.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like they feel they're about to give Iron Man the push he should have always had, and he and... Forceworks, which is basically a revamped West Coast Avengers.
It's very much like what they did when they turned like JLI into like Extreme Justice over at DC. Like they turned the lighter, funnier book, which was West Coast Avengers, into Forceworks, which was like not fun.
Yeah,
and suddenly like Wanda's in the cocktail dress. It was a very weird moment.
Thor is Eric Masterson. He's got like a ponytail and like a denim
Thunderstrike.
Vest. Thunderstrike, right, yeah. So it's wild. You can see, like, at the time they thought the cartoon was going to take this franchise over the top.
Well, the X-Men cartoon was so big that it makes sense. They were like, well, clearly we're in the cartoon business now.
We've got lightning in a bottle.
I only know who, like, the Gray Gargoyle is because I watched that cartoon. And I do remember watching a lot of episodes in it because I liked Julia Carpenter. However, I don't remember anything that ever happened in it, which is perhaps indicative of why it wasn't as big a hit as the X-Men one. That said... Maybe it is it on Disney Plus? Maybe it's time
it sure
to reassess the
it
90s
sure
Iron Man cartoon.
It sure
a reappraisal.
Is. It's just amazing to me that they went so hard with breaking Iron Man into the zeitgeist and it flops. And then 15 years
later. It never worked
later,
until 2008 when suddenly he became the biggest superhero in the world,
15,
which was shocking.
And 15 years later, it worked spectacularly well.
Yeah. I mean, my mother, who like doesn't even like comics, but I feel like the comics she read when she was a kid were like Iron Man and the Green Lantern and stuff. She, you know, because everybody read comics back then. Imagine.
Yeah.
she was always like, I can't believe they're making an Iron Man movie. She's like, I read that when I was a kid. I didn't even know he was still around. I'm like, oh, he is. And for people who are interested in how that movie came to be, I have an interview with the former Marvel CEO Peter Cuneo on the Patreon, patreon.com/throughbrocast, that is about him coming in the bankruptcy, turning Marvel around, creating Marvel Studios with the help of other people, obviously, and then selling the company to Disney. It's a fascinating look into the corporate stuff, which is often opaque to us people on the ground who must look up in awe at the floating space palace, Disneyopolis. But Spencer, you have a ticket to ride now aboard the Mousecraft.
That's right.
With this beautiful first issue, art by Julius Otwa, colors by Alex Sinclair, edited by Sarah Brunstad. Who's the letters on this? I should check.
That's Rob Caramagna, who I got to hang out with at New York Comic Con.
I love the mixed case. I was so happy to see mixed case because all the X-Men books have gone back to block caps and I had gotten so used to the mixed case on Krakoa. I really loved this. I was going to be proud of you no matter what. But the reason we're recording this not before the issue came out, but after, is because, you know, my podcast is not an Avengers podcast. I wasn't sure that I would be like, oh my God, I must ask Spencer pressing questions about his first issue of Iron Man. But then I read it. It was one day after we had dinner and you talked about the experience you had signing early copies at New York Comic Con and how many people had come up to you later in the con to be like, hey, dude, that issue's really good. And I was like, oh, okay, word on the street. And then I got to read it the following morning, and I got to tell you, it bangs. Like, I would have been proud of you no matter what, because you're my friend and I love you. But I am so proud of you for putting together something this polished as the debut on the Marvel stage that you're making. This is only your second comic after Waller versus Wildstorm at DC, which was a miniseries and which was Black Label, which that's a very different kind of comic making. There's a big lead time. There's more general freedom about what you can do with it. This is a very different beast, and I am impressed.
Well, first, thank you so much, Connor. You're one of the people whose opinions about this comic matters most to me. So the fact that it lands for you is both a vote of confidence and a measure of relief to me.
That's very sweet.
I have, as you mentioned, never done an ongoing series.
Like a monthly, yeah, right. Even like a monthly miniseries. The Black Label stuff is a different kind of release schedule.
I had the better part of a year to write Waller versus Wildstorm. And then the revisions process.
That's faster.
Yeah, like it's on a compressed schedule, but like, that taught me that the real writing in comics happens during the lettering stage, which is after the art comes in, because you need to make sure that the words match the expressions on the characters' faces and the rhythm of it changes.
You're doing the lettering pass and you have to make sure that the dialogue you wrote and the narration you wrote actually fit with the comic that now exists.
And now I am learning what a luxury all of that was. I feel like Lucille Ball on the chocolate conveyor belt.
Right.
We just released one. We are in the terminal stages of finalizing two. Well,
you're working on six.
Yeah. I just turned in a revision before we recorded this for issue six. Issue four, which was just solicited, Julius is taking those two issues off because issue six is going to kick off a major arc. So we're starting to get pages in from four while Julius is working on three. So at any moment now, we are in four different comic books, like at various phases of production.
And they have to sequentially read into one another, but you have to jump around in your revision process.
That's right. And also, you know, some of that is really, really helpful because it's great to know what six definitely is around the time I have to finalize two for print, because like you have much more of a, me at least, I'm not fully flying by the seat of my pants. Like I've given Marvel plot descriptions through issue I don't know if I should say.
You also are used to writing under pressure. You're a foreign policy journalist with a Pulitzer Prize. I mean, you have to turn stuff around quickly on a pretty regular basis, but this is a different kind of art form. It is.
It is. I am someone who's used to operating on extremely compressed deadlines. Not saying I love that, but it's a skill that I've built up over two decades. I pride myself on not missing deadlines. This is just like a whole lot of them. So far, it feels like I've eaten the chocolates as they come off the machine. Sometimes
for the kids,
I'm reaching very far.
Spencer, for the kids, I Love Lucy was a sitcom in the 50s. Google Lucille Ball Chocolate Factory, and you will understand this joke. I had to explain The Simpsons to these kids, Spencer. You can't go to Lucy, for God's sake.
I have faith that the kids eventually become familiar with some of the classics of comedy.
Oh, they do. And they've all learned a lot about the 90s from listening to us talk on my show, which I always enjoy.
It is really, really a fast-paced thing in an exciting way. I love what in journalism we call deadline poetry. How good can I make this thing by 4 o'clock? Because at 4 o'clock...
Because then it's got to go.
It's got to go. And I'm going to make it... I'm going to spend some time, not as much time as I would ever want, but I'm going to spend time to make this thing read as beautifully as I can and pay as much attention to detail as I can, especially because like this issue that we're going to talk about is an issue one. You want to make sure that this thing works on like several different levels for several different sorts of reader.
Mm-hmm.
So like if you have read a ton of Iron Man comics, there's a lot of references here that if you've never read an Iron Man comic, you can dwy it all out.
That's why I'm going to, like, when we go through it, I'm going to need you to point these out in a bunch of cases, I imagine, because I recognize certain armors as like, oh, that's from back in the day or whatever, but you're going to, you know, a lot of it went over my head.
Yeah.
I will say that when Justine Hammer rounded the corner, I let out a big gay cheer. So, you know.
I'm very happy for that.
Certain things did hit. But it also felt very accessible to me as someone who is not a regular Iron Man reader or who wasn't before Jerry's run. You accomplished the job because with a number one, especially a number one and an ongoing character like this who is so long in the tooth publication-wise, you have the devoted fans who are going to be pissed if you get one continuity thing wrong. And then you have people who are like, okay, theoretically, what if I jumped on here with number one? Am I going to be completely lost? And I think you struck a good balance here. I was just impressed with how many moving parts are active, with how tightly plotted the whole thing is. It's 30 pages and it reads really briskly. Shout out to editor Sarah Brunstad, also the editor on Betsy Braddock, Captain Britain by a friend of the pod, Tini Howard. She is good at that kind of thing, I think. But it feels, for instance, a lot tighter than Waller versus Wildstorm, which was a little bit more sweeping because it had the space to be, right?
Yeah.
And with a monthly comic like this, it has to be a lot more bam, and yet not feel like you're punching us in a way that's not fun. It has to
be Waller versus Wildstorm is 32 pages an issue. Issue one is 25. All subsequent issues, as far as I'm aware, are 20. So you really have to develop narrative economy and then like cool rhythms within that like tightly compressed space. Like eventually it just becomes a matter of me in my little notepad writing diagrams for how many pages scenes are, what the page turns are, what am I writing building to, what's the fun throw, what's the gut punch from one scene to another, what unites the issue thematically, and how can we start doing form and content throughout each of those scenes and do them in a way so that they build naturally, so that there's a progression, so it doesn't feel like I've just rushed you through a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, and I guess it is 25 because I'm looking at my PDF is 30, but one of those pages is the cover, and then there's the four pages at the end that are sort of the introductory material. So yeah, 25 pages, really tight.
I promise you it's 25, yeah.
Oh, I mean, I know you know.
Yeah.
But I didn't actually do math because I'm not especially good at that.
Listen, if you want to know what will humble you on math, have a 9-year-old and proctor her math homework.
Ooh, tough.
So many like anxieties about school that as an adult, you figure are like lost to you.
Behind you except in anxiety dreams.
Exactly. And then suddenly you have to teach math after school every day to a child.
Suddenly you have to teach your daughter how to subtract. Yeah, I would find that difficult because I gotta be honest, subtraction, it trips me up. And I know that that sounds insane, but it's like, I can do it. It's just, if you do it in my head, I will probably sometimes be a little bit off, especially if there's a seven. And that just, it feels like they're just not right. I don't respect what they're doing. I think that they should be an eight or a six, personally.
We're doing like three-digit multiplication in her class, and she writes out a multiplication equation. And she said, you know what this is? And I'm like, what's that? She goes, that's a base-level algorithm.
Ooh.
Like, I can't believe...
Your nine-year-old?
I can't believe my progeny, my nine-year-old progeny has just told me that.
Wow.
I know, it's incredible. Tony Stark level.
Yeah, I love that. She's like Moon Girl.
Loving that. Her sister is the bigger comic fan in the family, though.
Yes, well, I've seen the cosplay, which is cute. The Halloween looks and whatnot.
Anyway.
I'm not going to dox your children on the show.
No,
I'm
I
just
don't,
saying.
I don't.
All right. Well, let's get into this issue because it is 25 rip-roaring pages of fun. The Stark-Roxxon War, Part 1. Big picture, what made you want to tell this story with Tony? This hostile takeover story. It's coming on the heels of a not dissimilar plot with Fei Long in the Jerry Duggan stuff. Mm-hmm. But this does feel... different.
It occurred to me while I was reading Jerry's, before any of this was remotely an actual possibility, that I would come on to Iron Man, because we knew like Fall of X eventually would get his company back.
Mm-hmm.
If Tony Stark was about to take control of Stark Unlimited again, as Fei Long has just made it a weapons manufacturer again, that period of transition is going to be so difficult that if I were not necessarily a rival, because we can talk about this in a second, but like what Stark Unlimited is on Earth 616 is an interesting question. But if I were a company, in either a similar space or wished to rapidly scale up into the sort of things that Stark Unlimited does, then this is kind of the perfect time to assemble a consortium and launch a hostile takeover, because from a regulatory perspective, I know this isn't going to sound like a fun way of introducing a story.
No, keep going. Talk regulations to me.
If I try and buy your publicly traded company, I can freeze your operations in place. I got to a point where I was like, I did reporting on this and just like started talking to people who do M&A and who do securities law. This is a really good time to launch a hostile takeover of Tony Stark in a way that would frustrate his attempts to stop Stark Unlimited from being a weapons company.
Dad, if you're listening, by the way, you should read Spencer's comic. I think you would like it. My dad worked in corporate law for 40 years. It's a crazy world.
So... when A, I got the book, and then B, because of certain scheduling things happening, we needed to introduce the book with a 3-issue arc and have that arc sort of set up and contextualize a number of choices that Iron Man is going to make further out in the run, it struck me as like, this would be a really great way to take the baton from Jerry's run. If you are Tony Stark is written by me, everything in Jerry's run is fresh in your mind. The Fall of X has just happened. You have just lived through it.
Mm-hmm.
And now here comes a supervillain science consortium and the world's largest oil company, which is involved in a number of shenanigans over in Al Ewing's Immortal Thor.
Mm-hmm.
That struck me as a way to tell the kind of story that I like to tell, with certain preoccupations about the intermingling of weapons manufacturing, capitalism, and geopolitics, and get us into a kind of Iron Man story, and accordingly, a kind of Iron Man mode that will constantly be raising stakes to Stark level problems. Part of the challenge of writing Iron Man. This is not Spider-Man who can be undone by, like, that electricity bill.
Mm-hmm.
This is someone with a tremendous amount of resources and also a tremendous amount of internal resourcefulness. So being able to challenge him requires scale. This book is going to continually expand in scale. I figured what better way to start with that than do a kind of play on a frequent Iron Man trope, Tony Stark loses control of Stark Unlimited.
Yeah, I mean, it's happened a couple times now, and I'm not even like a big Iron Man reader. At a certain point, it's like, Tony, where'd you leave it? You need to like leave yourself a note. I left my company on the coffee table and, you know, that kind of thing. But this feels different. This feels like a different way for it to happen.
Yeah.
It's one that makes a ton of sense to me, given how Jerry's run ended, which was Emma using her telepathic manipulations of the stock market to make Tony rich again at the expense of a lot of supervillains. And it makes sense that some of those supervillains would now want to collect.
That's right. The war is going to go. If you're familiar with a book by a guy named Kai-Fu Lee called AI Superpowers, basically it's a book that looks at differences between China's path to artificial intelligence and Silicon Valley's. Part of what's amazing about that book is it talks about Chinese corporations frequently engaging in cyber attacks against one another.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it would be a dramatic way to start if we're like literalizing some corporate warfare, which to me also points to a way that warfare is going to take place outside of considerations of national sovereignty in the future. This is a battle for total control of what is, in the context of the Marvel Universe, one of the most important strategic assets there is. In our world, Stark Unlimited is probably best analogous to TSMC, the Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturer that makes like over 90% of the semiconductor chips that we use in really everything from military grade electronics to consumer electronics. A stunningly powerful corporation, both in terms of its scaled clean energy applications and, of course, the patents that Tony Stark has for the Iron Man armor. Control of Stark Unlimited. I really wanted, with Stark and Roxxon, to show that these two entities are kind of peer competitors. I feel like there's a tendency to think of Roxxon, because like Roxxon is so clearly evil-coded in the Marvel Universe, to think of it as like this giant overarching conglomerate, whereas Stark Unlimited is still like, you've got this hands-on CEO.
Right. Roxxon is like Exxon. It's, you know, yeah, namesake.
It's, that's
and
why
it's
called that. Yeah.
I would assume, yes.
Yeah.
But it's a faceless corp. You're like, who is in charge of Exxon Mobil? I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. You know what I mean?
Well, it used to be Rex Tillerson very recently. But,
it's
yeah,
not.
I take your point. Yeah, it's not. Point being, we also see like Iron Man tinkering in his garage, like a kind of Silicon Valley founding myth figure. You know, the person who runs the business is the person who builds the stuff. So like more Woj than Jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
But were we to look at what the balance of like economic force in the Marvel Universe, these two things are probably rather equally scaled. That makes for, I think, a much more dramatic and higher stakes acquisition attempt.
Right. We don't hang out with Tony Stark's 5 million employees is the thing. So the matter of scale is not always obvious. It's like Wayne Industries at DC. We know it exists.
Right.
We know they have a bazillion dollars. But unless it's like Lucius Fox going, I made this cool new thing, we're not spending a lot of time thinking about who works there.
Yes, we don't spend a lot of time thinking about, like, when we see Tony Stark employees, you've got like Mrs. Arbogast, his secretary, or you've got high-level scientists.
Sure.
You don't often get the people on the factory floor.
That's what I mean. Like, oh, you know, Tony has had people working for him who have names that we've met before. Remembering that Stark is a conglomerate on the scale of one of those companies is an interesting way to reframe in. It also underlines why they would want, you know, it's not just, I mean, it's also, I like that you do both here. It's not just that they have a grudge against Iron Man, right? It's also that Stark, in and of itself, is valuable.
That's right.
Whether or not your dad used to fight Iron Man or not.
When we get to issues 2 and 3, we're going to go more into that. Like, it's not a revenge issue for certain characters.
Well, I think Justine clearly wants to, you know, settle some scores. Yeah.
Yeah.
But there is a practical level on which Melinda May doesn't give a shit about Tony Stark. Although she probably has some mysterious agenda that we haven't uncovered yet. So don't even worry about that just yet. We'll get there in a second.
Yes, it's a good business decision. It makes compelling capitalist sense to do this.
Right. It's not a supervillain plan by itself. Like, this is just something that happens all the time. Someone tried to do this at Disney, like last year.
Yeah, exactly. Also, you may have noticed in the world outside of our window, a way most corporations at this point grow is not by innovating, not by making new stuff that's valuable and serves an extant public need. They buy other corporations and grow that way.
Mm-hmm.
The acquisitive nature of capital.
Well, ExxonMobil was once Exxon.
Exxon,
you know, I mean,
and Mobil, yeah.
Right. So, case in point.
There's a very good book about this by Steve Cole called Private Empire, which is about the history of ExxonMobil and its development as, you know, a private empire. Anyway.
Well, let's get into the issue. We open with a scene in upstate New York, a union demonstration at a Stark factory that is quickly busted up by Hulkbusters, as it were, hulking out union busters, security guard types, who on the very first page explode into monsters to make sure that all of these no good Teamsters get the fuck off their lawn.
So they are not Hulkbusters.
No, I'm kidding, but they're union busters who are Hulks, was the joke. A Hulkbuster is a kind of Iron Man armor, isn't it? Am I wrong?
Yeah. No, you're right. A Hulkbuster is a kind of Iron Man armor.
I was trying to make an Iron Man joke. You got to throw me some bones here.
I couldn't tell. I just needed to say that, like, the reason why these characters are specifically these monster characters is a debt of gratitude that I owe to Al Ewing, writer of Immortal Thor, who is using Roxxon.
Mm-hmm.
And while he did not need to do this, came up with a way that allowed my story to go forward without stepping on the toes of his story. These first three issues, if Al had decided, as would have been his right, to keep Roxxon for Immortal Thor and what he's building for in Immortal Thor, these three issues would have just been something else. So I really owed Al a lot. And these Roxxon berserkers are the kinds of dudes we first saw. I think we first saw, but we definitely saw, certainly last saw, in Immortal Hulk. I wanted to kind of like gesture gratitude on the first page to Al for that.
There is also an homage to our friend Stephen Attewell, who passed away recently. The union leader here looks a lot like Stephen, and they called him Stephen. So you told me there was a shout out and I saw this and I smiled.
Yeah, if I could just take a moment. When Stephen passed away, they had a memorial service that I attended. It was shortly after I had gotten the pitch approved, I believe, for this story arc. And as I listened to his family recount his deep love of Marvel Comics during his too brief life, it occurred to me that I could do something to immortalize him there. And I mentioned that to his brother and his mother. Forevermore, my friend is in the Marvel Universe organizing the working class.
Doing what he did in real life.
Yeah.
For people who are not familiar with the back catalog, Stephen was my guest for the Sebastian Shaw episode. It's a really good one. Check it out if you have some time. It's sad that he is no longer with us, but luckily he leaves us a great body of work that we can all go back and enjoy, because he always made me think about these exact issues. This union storyline is an interesting one, because Tony bursts in to try and save these people and ends up, once he has neutralized the berserkers, in something of a tense conversation with Ramon Vicente, who is the inspector, the safety inspector.
Yeah, he's the guy actually running the union drive.
Tony wants to know why they're striking, and the reason is not as straightforwardly, uncomplicatedly a good, evil thing as one might hope. Tony is trying to stop weapons production that Fei Long put into place in Jerry's run, and these people are the ones who make those weapons. So they're going to be in a bad way if all of this stuff shuts down out of nowhere.
So just one quick clarification, they're not striking. They're organizing. This is a previously non-union shop.
They're trying to form a union.
Yes, so they have some possible institutional power to influence whatever it is that Stark is going to do with this factory where they happen to work. That's the impetus. The lockout is happening by management.
Right. Okay, yes.
A lockout is the opposite of a labor action. It's what we call a capital strike. It is capital stopping labor from operating in order to weaken it. And that's why the title of the issue is Capital Strike.
You can't come in here to organize. We're not letting you in the building.
Yeah. Tony shows up and he's like, what's this? Fuck this. I'm not, I didn't lock this building out. I didn't authorize this. We'll learn later that there's also some superhero related aspects of why these guys have locked the factory out without Tony Stark knowing. But on the factory floor, Ramon wants to issue a challenge to Tony about being an afterthought, about labor not factoring in to the machinations of the CEO of Stark Unlimited.
Well, Tony's making this big moral statement, isn't thinking about how it would affect all of the people who are employed in his factories.
Exactly. That's what I wanted to shine a light on. And Tony, a heroic character, sees that Ramon is making a compelling point, says that Ramon should continue to conduct his drive and Stark will recognize the union.
He says he'll recognize the union, which is, a very heroic CEO character. But he is a superhero. I mean, that's how it should be, right?
Yes. We'll be also, this is not the last time we will be asking about Tony's behavior in this particular moment. Having been part of union drives before, I can say the difference between an employer recognizing a union and an employer writing what a union wants into their contract are two very different things. Very, very different things. It is much easier for a CEO to say, I agree to recognize a union.
Well, it's a political play, right? It's saying your feelings are valid. That doesn't mean I will act on them.
Yes. And so we're going to be coming to this because, as we can see, Ramon is pretty skeptical of Iron Man.
Mm-hmm. And Tony says he's going to show, not tell, and doing a classic cool Tony Stark thing, suits up and flies off into the sky, but unfortunately immediately falls catastrophically many, 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 many feet down into the building because something has happened to his suit. We cut to a hospital room many weeks later. Tony is looking rough. It looks like that time that Christian Bale did The Machinist. Do you remember that? He like went from Batman where he had like roided out to then doing The Machinist where he was like anorexic and it was sort of shocking. There's a gaunt quality here.
If you're in a hospital for a long time, muscle density atrophy. They really do, especially if you are there because of like deep physical trauma, as Tony has. Like he's going to be in traction for a while, and building himself back up to superhero fighting status is going to be a huge difficulty. I wanted to gesture at Iron Man being somewhat older,
mm-hmm.
physical limits catching up with a man who can engineer his way out of anything.
But he's been doing it for 60 years now, not in the sliding time scale. But yeah, I mean, you know, it makes sense that he's not as spry as he was in the 60s.
Yeah, and also we need to signal for what this story is going to be and for what this run is going to be early on. Life is going to be knocking this pharaonically wealthy man down to size a lot, and he will have to scale up his resilience in order to match those challenges.
There's an interesting bit here where he explains why he doesn't optimize his interface with the armor, because doing that would require a direct plug-in in a part of his brain that is impacted by his alcoholism. That, like, an addictive brain, addictive personality should not do that. What inspired this little bit? Because it made me, so I was like, oh, that's smart. I like good explanations for why something can't be fixed easily.
The real inspiration was knowing that in Chris Cantwell's Iron Man, Chris does this brilliant thing where the suit dopes him.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a way of being like, oh, that's a really good dancing between the raindrops explanation for how it is that, like, this guy can be so constantly pummeled, having no superpowers of his own.
Right, that he can, you could beat the crap out of him, but he is not dying in the inside the suit.
Chris writes this very moving story about this alcoholic who has not properly realized that the suit is getting him high. Because Chris did that so perfectly, I wanted to show Iron Man learns something from it, but at the same time is kind of like still trying to optimize his relationship, particularly during this moment of like being in the hospital for a long time, as much as he can. So he kind of bargains with himself a little bit in that moment. You know, could he go back to a way of interacting with the Iron Man suit that for a moment he's ready to do it, but then realizes that it would compromise his sobriety? It is worth it to him to conquer that demon, keep that demon, if you will, bottled up, even if this guy's going to be chewing ibuprofen instead of letting himself like have the fentanyl patch.
Right. The several weeks he has spent in the hospital, though, have provided, as we see in the next scene, an opportunity for various members of the Stark board of directors to make their own political play for power in the wake of this chaotic reversion of the company to Tony. We meet a bunch of them in quick sequence here. Jack Kooning Jr. is the first one.
Yes.
You mentioned his father, so I Googled and I actually did recognize the character because I've read some of the Extremis stuff, because I saw the Iron Man 3 movie with Rebecca Hall and I wanted to know who the character was. And it doesn't end well for her, as it turns out.
No, it certainly doesn't. Well, so this is a nod to the Iron Man director of S.H.I.E.L.D. era. Forgive me, I don't know how to pronounce your name, Knauf or Knauf. I apologize.
I would have said Knauf, but Knauf is Knauf, so you could absolutely be right. It could be Knauf.
Apologies. I stand on your shoulders on this run. I wanted to use this character also because, like, Jerry is using Rhodey, and outside of Rhodey and Riri, there aren't very many Black characters in Iron Man's supporting cast and character history.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Kooning, the former Secretary of Defense in the, we'll just say, Knauf run, is dead.
Right.
And as far as I know, has not been resurrected. So I was like, okay.
About the right age to now have a son who's like 40 and causing trouble on the board.
Yeah. So we bring this guy in kind of in dad's role. Iron Man, of course, a very Oedipal character, famously difficult relationship with his own father, a villain that we choose in this book certainly had a difficult relationship with her father.
Yeah, I mean, I like the theme of trying to live up to daddy's legacy that is sort of continuing through here. Or in this scene also is AIM Scientist Supreme Monica Rappaccini.
Yeah.
She's kind of the bad dad herself, right? She's named after the story Rappaccini's Daughter, which is about a man who experiments on his child. And of course, this character experimented on her child in the Marvel Universe. As we know, I love an evil scientist mom who experiments on her child for funsies. So this is an archetype I always enjoy. She was voiced by Wendy McClendon Covey in the MODOK show.
Oh, now I have to watch that. Oh, wow. I didn't know Monica was in that.
Oh, yeah. She's like a regular in it. She's in it a bunch.
I love this character. She is going to have a big moment in issue 2. I really like writing her bouncing off of Tony Stark.
Does look a little bit like Justine Hammer, a character we will see later in the issue. But I would like to remind the readers at home that Justine wears red.
That's right.
And Monica wears green. Their hair's different too, though. Justine does the swoopy on the side. Yeah. She has like the Stacey London gray streak in it. Both great characters. I just did think, man, they're going to be quite the team.
After issue 5, we will really see... I feel like my run can be roasted as really super villainous heavy.
Well, you know what? You are a Chris Claremont devotee like anyone else. And there is nothing wrong with a cavalcade of glamorous super villainesses ruining a man's day.
There's going to be a lot of them. And Monica's a very fun one to write.
I liked it, though, because part of the vibe of this new run is how divorced Tony is. He's like the most divorced guy. Obviously, his wedding to Emma was not real, quote unquote. But as Jerry wrote it so beautifully, they both kind of came to really enjoy it and care about it, but both understand that there was absolutely no way it was tenable long term. I think that it makes a lot of sense for him to be dumped, essentially, because he would have gone for it.
We know that.
Is what you get at the end of Jerry's run. We know that.
Yeah.
If she had been game to just go for it, he would have actually gone for it. And she's like, Tony, come on. We need to be realistic here. To be dumped by Emma Frost and then suddenly be confronted by like 3 unbelievably intelligent women in power suits who are your professional rivals. It's fun thematically. It makes a lot of sense. It's him coping with the loss of that romantic relationship and trying to get his company back. And these women who are not un-Emma-like are standing in his way.
I think that's an excellent summary.
Well, what can I say? I've got good story instincts, I think they say. That's what I'm told.
This is where we learn what the Gambit is. Monica and Roxxon have combined to take over the company. The board that will decide the fate of Stark Unlimited in this acquisition is a board appointed by Fei Long. So we are really going like right where Jerry left the series. We're starting really right there. He would not have had time to replace this board.
Especially if the board conspires to knock him out of the sky and put him in the hospital for like 4 weeks so that they can maneuver the hostile takeover while he's in the hospital.
Certainly take advantage of that opportunity.
Right.
The
other character who is introduced here, and I had to check if she had ever appeared in 616, is Melinda May.
Yes.
Of the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. TV show. She is presented here as someone who, and this is a nice bit of synchronicity with Declan Shalvey's Mystique, where we see Nick Fury Jr. and Maria Hill trying to reestablish S.H.I.E.L.D. with like zero budget. This is someone who was a public servant and has now gone private for whatever reason in the wake of S.H.I.E.L.D. blowing up.
You know, I would just say it's money. I've known a lot of military officers who, as they ascend to bird or flag rank, decide that what comes next is going to be a moment of making the kind of money that they could
private
have never
sector.
Made.
Yeah,
they could have never made while serving. And so that's sort of what I'm putting out.
It's what every official in a government does when the other party wins the presidency, right? It's like they all go take
it. Yeah.
If they're not already in a political position, they go and take a job somewhere doing some kind of consulting, and then they wait for the next go round.
Yeah.
I imagine that Valerie Cooper, in those brief moments when she is not employed to police mutant kind, is doing this kind of thing.
Yeah, like half the Biden National Security Cabinet is a partner at West Exec Advisors, for instance.
Right.
Which is a business consultancy. Melinda May's on that kind of tip at this moment.
What made you want to use this character? She is not very developed yet in the comics continuity, so she's kind of a blank slate. She was very popular on that TV show, played by Ming-Na Wen, an actress I quite enjoy.
This took a couple go-arounds with Sarah to figure out, like, who would be right to cast in this role.
Which character to put in this part?
Yeah, because I wanted someone on the board who, how to put this without, we already have through the Jack Kooning Jr. character, someone who's like outright hostile to Tony, who looked on that era of Iron Man as S.H.I.E.L.D. director in an antagonistic way. I wanted someone who would have worked for
him when he was S.H.I.E.L.D. director.
Yeah, to now be in this position of power over him, and who, from an operative level perspective, as we'll see in subsequent issues, has perhaps a very different take on Iron Man's tenure.
Yeah, I hadn't even really thought about that, but these two would have a lot of history because of how much he's worked with S.H.I.E.L.D. and at one point, as you point out, led the division. So he knows this woman, whether or not she's been in a lot of comics. And that's always a fun thing to tease out. I have a particular soft spot for Ming-Na in any... She's Ming-Na Wen now, but she...
Yeah, she's great, yeah.
But in the 90s, it was just like Madonna. She was just Ming-Na, right?
Mm.
I just have a particular soft spot for her because she was on ER back in the day. And when I was in high school on a choir trip, I had a 104-degree fever and I ended up stuck back in the hotel room watching ER. And I hallucinated Ming-Na's character turning directly to me and saying, "Connor." And I'll tell you what, it was the most engaged I've ever been in an episode of ER that wasn't about the lesbian on crutches. She was the best character on that show.
She was the best character in that show.
Dr. Weaver!
But, like, there's never going to be a moment when, in my mind, I don't see Eric LaSalle, like, doing the karate chop from, like, the credits montage.
Oh, for sure. Remember when the helicopter fell on what's-his-name?
God.
This was also, like, was George...
This is not an ER podcast. We can't do that. The kids...
Yeah, okay.
They might have gone back to I Love Lucy. They have not watched ER, but they should. It's very good.
You should. You should watch ER.
At the very least, like the first four or five seasons.
The first two seasons are just...
Yeah, I mean, the first two,
banger.
Like, it was just Emmys out their ass, right? But I was into it later for the Alex King. That's where I got into Alex Kingston and later was forced to watch Doctor Who briefly.
God. Okay.
I tried.
I have never tried.
I support you.
Okay.
Anyway, so that's a character we'll be seeing more of, I take it, because... It's a name. You could have made this a totally new character, or it could have been someone like Kooning Jr. who has an association, whatever. You wanted to use someone who readers would immediately go, "Oh, I know who this character is." Some readers, anyway.
Once it was brought up that, like, she doesn't have, like, a super extensive Earth 616.
Yeah, no, I think she had a one-shot, and she's been, like, some minis, but she doesn't have a long publication history.
Yeah, so let's give her some shine.
Yeah, I think it's a fun character to loop in. She seems to be in league with Monica, or at least that is how she is presenting it here, which is an interesting thing, of course, because AIM and S.H.I.E.L.D. were at odds, right? Capitalism makes for strange bedfellows is sort of the overarching message of this scene to me in a way that I find compelling.
Like, if you've read Waller versus Wildstorm, quite a big theme of that book running through it is there aren't heroes and villains as much as there are clashing interests, and people will find themselves on a lazy Susan-like trajectory of aligning with different aspects of the hero-villain spectrum according to that. So I wanted to throw some of that stuff in there.
Well, it's hard to be a hero in a system that is fundamentally unheroic in a lot of ways, right? The intrinsic dilemma of characters like Tony Stark or Bruce Wayne, and many of the best stories about Iron Man or about Batman are about them grappling with how the way that they make their money is not necessarily in line with their values as their superheroic identity, right? So it's an interesting point of conflict always. I really like, for people like me who I work in the arts, I've never been inside a corporate office in my life. I liked the little breakdown here of like what had just happened, because I was like, I'm following. But the clear narration here of they've got me in checkmate. If I shut down the plants, the shareholders will sue, which will compel the board to do this and this and that. Jack did this with AIM, AIM did this with Rock. So I was like, OK, got it. It made me feel like I was along for the ride. And then, as a reward, you gave me these tweets. And I have to say, I typically find tweets and things like this in comics or in prose, honestly, like, to not work. And I can tell that you are just as brain poisoned by that app as I am, because these felt very real.
The lettering notes to Rob on this are fully deranged. I'd be like, okay, so we've got the handle, then we're gonna play with the handle.
Speaking of the handles, by the way, can we just give a shout out to No More Mutants 1488? I cannot believe you got that past S&P. Good for S&P. It's funny.
I very much agree. I was not sure that was going to survive. I asked no questions when it turned out that as the drafts kept coming back, that was
not one seems to have an issue. All right, great.
That's right. We just had to be like, so there just needs to be a family emoji in between love family, love God.
The family emoji really sold it, because truly the most hateful, disgusting people on social media who will call you a racial slur to your face or whatever, you do click through to their bio and it is immediately,
yeah, like,
love God, love my family, Corinthians this.
Right, exactly.
Girl dad. And you're like, geez, guy, come on.
Yeah, so he rewards himself with some doom scrolling after being checkmated.
This, I have to assume, is somewhat autobiographical, right? It has to be. If you're a journalist in politics with 150,000 Twitter followers or whatever, sometimes I have to assume in a dark night of the soul, you have found yourself.
Yes, I'm happy to say this is like no longer something that I do. I am extremely rarely on Twitter. For this launch, I've been more on Twitter than I've been in 2 years, I'm happy to say, but I ain't staying.
No, we've been accountability buddies on about staying.
Yes, and thank you for that. But yeah, sometimes you got to mine some unfortunate and...
Write what you know. And sometimes what you know is pathetic. And if you're the guy's having a pathetic moment, you write him how you were when you were pathetic in your own mind, you know?
I just also really like the visual of Iron Man doom scrolling in the Prime Armor helmet, like this incredibly.
I liked
powerful.
That too. Yeah. Yes, because it's projecting the tweets directly into his eyes. I assume, right?
Yes, exactly. That's why the eyes are. That's why the eyes.
Which is hell.
There.
That's true hell.
And then I also just like the idea that he's too rich to type. He's just like dictating. What his posts will be.
It's also very like my mom coded. Like, again, if you're trying to make Tony feel a slightly, like, I was just talking about this with Eve Ewing's Exceptional X-Men. Kitty Pryde obviously can't age too much because of the sliding time scale or whatever, but the way she talks to the teenage characters in this very much feels to me as a 36-year-old,
yes,
like the way I speak to teenagers. And it makes the vibe of the book really work as like a millennial Gen Z thing, even if we can't explicitly say how old everybody is. And this has a similar vibe where it's like, yeah, my mom talks to type into her phone. And I am mystified by it, but that's because I can type a million words a minute with my thumbs on the phone because I grew up doing it.
That rebounds on Iron Man pretty badly, which I think is the appropriate lesson of involving Iron Man in social media.
Yeah, I mean, he's doom scrolling and comes across Flying Tiger _ because he couldn't get Flying Tiger without the _, which is sad for the Flying Tiger, a character I had never heard of, but I'm thrilled to meet him.
We've got an old Masters of Evil character here, and we explain, this is how deranged it was. I do explain right there the _, because as he says, original account censored at 100K followers.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, so he did have it, but then
he
got
Flying
banned
Tiger,
for being... He got shadow banned for being
asshole.
A supervillain,
yeah.
So now he's got a new account. Got it. Okay, yeah, you're right. You did.
I'm sorry to say I thought all this through.
No, that's very real. Again, life imitates art. Art imitates life. The verisimilitude here. But the point is, he ends up in like a Twitter fight with a supervillain, which I think is funny.
Yes.
That just goes on for like a second. And then he's like, what am I fucking doing? Puts on the suit and flies off to handle it. And he is pulled into a fight with the Flying Tiger and Tiger Shark, a character you and
who
I just discussed in the Namor episode.
That's
briefly.
Right. And I had to silence myself to not say, well, you know, fly. I'm going to use Tiger
Having
Shark
just
and
written
Iron Man
Tiger
as,
Shark.
As,
right.
As,
yeah.
As a
no.
Matter of fact. I also just like the idea that Tiger Shark has no patience for Flying Tiger, and also that Flying Tiger is so into tigers that he doesn't get that Tiger Shark is a kind of shark.
He's a shark-themed kind of tiger villain, yes. Not a tiger-themed villain. Yeah, no, I liked that. It's Celine style. Like, you need to fit the theme, whether or not you
That's
do.
Right.
Sometimes it's a stretch. But if the theme is this, can you make it work?
Yeah, I also had, like, there he is, like, yelling out, like, Tiger Pack, bitch. And tigers do not, like, cluster in packs. A cluster of tigers is not called a pack. So
no, it is not called a pack of tigers. Right. No, he doesn't know much about tigers. He just likes their vibe.
This is some self-indulgent writing, but I thought it was funny.
It also is helpful. Actually, I don't know. Does he have a tiger head or is it a mask?
Let's not pull the threads of the sweater.
Okay, but my point is just that
I truly don't know. It looks
whether
like,
or not
it's a
real
it's a
head or a mask.
I think it's a mask.
Whether or not it's a mask, it's so funny in this last exchange that they have when it's staring up at him. He's just like, you are washed, but it's coming out of like a grinning tiger face. I laughed out. I don't know why that was so funny to me.
It is very funny.
It's because of the way that Julius draws it. It's just like that tiger is thrilled to tell this old guy he's washed in this burning laundromat. He is so delighted.
This is also our first clue. I mean, I'm assuming you put something up saying this. We're spoiling the whole issue.
Yeah, we're going through the whole thing. I talked about Justine in like minute two.
You did. This is also our first foreshadow that we're going to see Justine Hammer, because as Crimson Cowl, head of the Masters of Evil, we've got two Masters of Evil here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she used to pit these guys against the Thunderbolts back in the day. Right? Yes?
She did. Yeah, that's
right. Yeah, I was like, I read that.
No, you're right. The Busiek Thunderbolts, it's great.
I am more widely read than people give me credit for. No, I love the Crimson Cowl, mostly because in that Avengers Alliance Facebook game, there was no one you fought more than the Crimson Cowl besides the UFOs and Diablo the Alchemist.
Ooh.
I didn't know UFOs. Who Diablo or the UFOs were, but I recognized the Crimson Cowl from, like, the issues of Busiek Thunderbolts I had bought.
Yeah. And also, like, that design goes really hard. Like,
it's so good. It looks a little bit like the evil witch from He-Man, right? Or She-Ra.
Yeah.
Is it She-Ra? Or Voltron? I don't even remember which one it is. But you know exactly the witch I'm talking about.
But also, like, what was the name of, like, the floating wizardy sidekick character from He-Man, because she also kind
that's
of
that's what I'm
like
thinking
that.
Of right, because she also looks like that.
Yeah.
She looks like the Shadow Weaver, which is
yeah, I don't
She-Ra,
know what the fuck that thing
and
is
then
called,
but also like I want to call him like Gleeble, but that's like not
it might as well be
Orko. Yeah. I don't know, it's something
Orko
like
I think it
is
Orko.
Orko?
I think
am I right?
I think
oh
you're
my
right there.
God,
I'm too young.
I'm too young. I never watched He-Man. I'm a child by comparison to He-Man watchers. So
it is Orko. Oh man.
Oh, wow. Well, good guess me.
A lot of design.
Anyway, so okay, the Master of Evil are here.
Yeah.
Flying Tiger illustrates the fact that Tony is washed by pointing out if he had just worn his anti-magic armor that he's just been talking about for 50 fucking issues, then that wouldn't have happened to him because, oh, we attacked you with magic is the implication.
Yeah, here's where he realizes that the reason why he fell out of the sky, which he's like run all of these diagnostics on and can't answer that, is because of magic and his typical reluctance to entertain magic as a thing.
Well, if you're a scientific genius,
yeah,
it's an
exactly.
annoying thing to have to deal with magic as a factor in your day-to-day.
Exactly. It's like whatever half of the brain that you listener inclined toward, this is the other half that you find mm-hmm. annoying and tests your patience when you have to utilize it. So that's Tony with magic. He immediately, because obviously how he could he not once goaded like that, now he's got to go get the Mysterium armor. And he figures like,
right,
problem solved.
Why wasn't he wearing it out of curiosity? Because I'm sure there are people who are going to go, why didn't he wear it? And it's like, well, because that's not what the story is. But
well,
is it because Emma gave it to him? Like, I'm dealing with a lot emotionally right now.
In the first scene where we introduce Iron Man, we give some foreshadow misdirection about this and say that, like, he wouldn't have thought to wear his anti-magic Mysterium armor for a routine check-in. And then when he's on the east side of Manhattan and he's going to a laundromat that just blew up to fight an asshole like Flying Tiger, he's not going to like fly to Long Island City in one armor, get the Mysterium armor and do that.
He was already wearing one of the regular ones.
Yeah. And during the scene, right before he gets to the board meeting, the way he goes about his response to the bleeding edge armor malfunctioning is to say that he's running a global armor update via the Stark servers. So now every armor, from his perspective, whatever it was that happened to the bleeding edge that made him fall out of the sky, now he's fixing that across all platforms. So he's got like an endless supply, however many suits of armor that it's canon that Iron Man has. He has all of them, except for the bleeding edge at this moment, which is probably getting a mechanical tune-up as well as a software one. The way this actually worked was that we knew we would be building up to something with the Mysterium armor. And I was just like, Julius, give me the two Iron Man armors you like drawing the most.
And those are the ones he's going to wear in this issue?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I just wanted Julius to have fun, right? This is his first time, like, drawing, like, a major ongoing like this, just as it's my first time writing it. And I want him to have as much fun with it as he possibly can. A whole lot of this stuff I figured out on the fly, because Cerebro listeners can hear this exclusive. There were necessary Mysterium-related beats to this arc that came about because shortly after I got the gig, there was an Avengers office dinner that I was invited to, in which I got to meet, among other people, Jerry Duggan, and got to express my appreciation for his Iron Man run and, of course, his X-Men. As we were talking through at the table what, like, my coalescing story was going to be, Jerry naturally piped up a couple times, be like, wait, but the Mysterium armor, that would be a problem that he could solve with the Mysterium armor.
Yeah, it's a pretty powerful suit of armor.
Yeah, so
you were like, time to get rid of it. I mean, yeah, that exactly. Narratively makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. So I was like, okay, let's spend some time in the first issue explaining why we've got a Mysterium armor problem.
Because it was necessary for Jerry's big finale, but it is a very powerful suit of armor for Iron Man to wear month to month in a regular Iron Man story. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Also, in a story that's about your company and your technology being stolen, it's fun for him to lose it because it gets stolen by a rival corporate espionage type person.
That's right. So, okay, so I guess, like, skipping forward.
Well, I mean, we're now, like,
We're there. So, yeah.
Yeah, he goes to go get the Mysterium armor from the warehouse he left it in Queens. And there he is attacked again by the Berserkers, who are, for people who have not read stories with Roxxon Berserkers in them, they look like Hulks, but they're purple, basically.
Yeah.
And they got, like, sharp teeth like Baraka in Mortal Kombat.
They're more monstery than a Hulk. We got some monster bros.
He shoots them with some repulsor rays, and he asks them to tell him why they're in his warehouse before he... And that is when he is interrupted. This isn't your warehouse, Tony. What? It's mine. Justine Hammer. Can I just say, first of all, Justine Hammer looks great.
She looks so good. I couldn't believe it.
She has never looked this hot ever. I was wowed. This, I can only assume, is I've infected you somehow with my particular brain poison. But bringing back a female character who was murdered in your first issue, I saluted the flag that was my love for you.
Thank you.
We were just talking about the Crimson Cowl earlier, but for people who don't know this character, great character. She's been dead for like 12, 13 years. And I love that you bring it up here and have her go, yeah, I did die, but it's fine. We're in a comic book. Who cares? Also, magic, which you never think about.
Magic, which you never think about, has brought you back. And now, as we learn here, this is also a nod to what Al's doing. Roxxon has powerful allies in other dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
Roxxon has now the power to bring her back. And I also just love the idea that, like, you bring her back so, yes, she can get her vengeance specifically on Tony Stark, but also because, like, that's a good business decision.
I was like, oh, of course, because who else would you bring in? People who don't know her deal, her father, Justin Hammer, is like an evil Howard Stark. Like, they're very parallel characters. They make a lot of sense. They have fraught relationships with their fathers, living or deceased. They have all kinds of unfortunate romantic entanglements. She had a daughter with the Mandarin who then matricided her. That's how she's been dead for a long time. she's just as messy as Tony, just as smart in her way as Tony, and just as savvy in the business world as Tony. And I was like, this is going to be fun.
The thing that she didn't have that gets us to our classic Iron Man battle is she has taken the Mysterium armor as a final component. Now Justine Hammer is the new Ironmonger.
Her Ironmonger suit, which is huge.
It's enormous. We're going to be seeing a lot.
I like the idea of Justine dabbling in magic because her Crimson Cowl, I know she wasn't the first Crimson Cowl, but the way that she did it was always very witchy.
Yes.
Theming, even though it was technology, right? So the idea that Roxanne's like, oh, hey, we're working with interdimensional entities. And she's like, yeah, fuck, get me some of that. Mysterium? I've been dead for a while. Tell me, what's that? What's that about?
This is, you know, a new business climate,
mm-hmm.
as she will be explaining later on. Let's just pause for a moment because I love this design so much.
It's great.
When Julius came back with this, with like all the scary cables, you can lose an afternoon just going through the detail in the suit. And then it's colored by Alex Sinclair, one of the greatest colorists in comic book history. The only colorist that Jim Lee will work with is coloring my book. I couldn't believe it. He's an amazing guy as well. We recently got to go out to dinner at New York Comic Con, where I could just sort of both gush about his work here and also hear stories from the early days of Wildstorm Studios and then Wildstorm Comics, where he and his colleagues pioneered digital comics coloring. And now seeing this here is just incredible.
I love the panel where she activates it by tapping the brooch. Tapping the lapel. Brooch.
Yep.
Because, you know, Tony does that thing where he clicks the palm of his glove or whatever. And so it was fun to give her a little, I'm going to tap my jewelry and then turn into a giant, monstrous, hulking, masculine Ironmonger figure, which is kind of fun because, again, she's presenting a very femme fatale thing, but then explodes into, like, not a femme fatale, but Zangief from Street Fighter mode. You know, like she's going to toss you around.
And does.
And how?
We're off to a battle of Nepo babies.
Yes, which is, again, I was just thinking, this character is so smart to bring back now. It just feels like this is exactly the debate that we're having a lot of the time.
Here we have, for the X-Men fans, our first explicit reference to Emma.
Yes.
As Tony says, my wife got me that suit, Justine.
How sad. Yeah. I heard you're not with her anymore.
Yep, we got some Tony Stark divorcee banter happening.
But it's also... this is why he's so fun with Madame Mask, right? Like, it's always fun to have Tony with a female villain because you immediately slip into that kind of Batman Catwoman vibe where it's like, we're trying to kill each other, but we're also flirting. Right. Yeah. And I like this moment where it's just like, he's like, why are you so interested in my love life? Just, and she's like, okay, I'm going to kill you now. We're just bantering.
Yeah. I mean, like, the way I kind of thought of that is just like, this is really not what Justine is here for.
No, she's really not here to fuck Tony Stark, but she can play the game.
Yeah.
To a point. When he starts making too many jokes, she's like, just to be clear, I've already won.
Yeah. This is where we sort of start revealing some major elements of this story. What they plan to do is corner the global arms and the global energy markets. So that's what the acquisition of Stark Unlimited by Roxanne and AIM is going to do. Now that Iron Man is running a corporation that manufactures weapons again, now all of a sudden, this is a time for a global oil giant that has some scary extra-dimensional ambitions, as we're learning in Immortal Thor, to go after the world's... I mean, I think it's fair to say... the world's state-of-the-art weapons manufacturer and take that into the fold. If that really happened, and I would note that out in rugged conditions, all of the petrogiants work with extensive networks of what we would euphemistically call private security contractors, which is to say mercenaries.
Yep.
In countries like Nigeria, murder people like Ken Saro-Wiwa, who object to the extractive, aggressive, acquisitive ambitions and practices of these companies and the human and ecological devastation that goes with that. So that's what's happening here. That's the moment where I tried to crystallize the stakes of this. If Iron Man loses this company, a strategic asset falls into the hands of the worst possible people it could have fallen into the hands of. We will deepen that in issue 3. But for now, Iron Man knows if he loses his company again, we're deeply fucked. Not just Iron Man is fucked. The world is fucked.
This would be an incredibly bad, bad thing to have happen. Not just for me personally. This is not a Tony Stark loses his company and it's going to be a bummer for him moment. This is a Tony Stark loses his company and it's going to be a big problem for the entire world.
Yes.
Moment, which is similar to what Jerry was doing in terms of Stark being weaponized against mutants specifically. But what Justine and Monica and Kooning Jr. want to do is corner the market on a much more subversive and subtle form of power that targets everyone.
And would change the balance of power in the world. So probably a bad time for Tony to find out that as part of this plan, stemming back to what happened in the fallout of the sky moment at the beginning of the issue, all of his Iron Man suits are now compromised. And it was the compromise happened by Iron Man loading that global armor update without realizing the Stark servers had been infected by the Berserkers using a joint Roxxon AIM extra dimensional.
A magical computer virus, essentially.
That's right.
So not something that his cybersecurity could easily detect.
Exactly. A magical computer virus has now destroyed all of the Iron Man suits, is all you need to know. They're all fucking off the table.
Because Justine can now control them.
Yes.
And make them do whatever she wants. So he can't really do much to her if he's wearing them.
All of the Iron Man armors are now compromised. He falls out of the sky really soon after just recovering barely from falling out of the sky. And now the things that can make up for his enormous physical vulnerabilities right now are no longer options for him. And that's where we're going to start this series.
It's time to eat a lot of chicken, hit the gym, do your
PP,
and build a new Iron Man suit.
And we also learn right before Justine balletically puts the Ironmonger back in the brooch.
Yeah, I love that panel too.
There's an Avengers traitor that's working with them. We'll find out who that is in subsequent issues.
One of your old Avengers allies. So someone who used to be a friend of Tony's, but it's not like a mole within the current Avengers.
Keep buying Iron Man and we'll see what happens here.
She says one of your old Avengers allies. So I was thinking of someone from the past.
I'm not confirming or denying anything. And we will get some clarity on what's going on here very, very soon.
Well, the Scarlet Witch is on the cover of the issue that was solicited today. So
she sure is. Yes, that's right. Issue 4 is going to have Wanda in it.
You heard it here first. Wobbs, if you're listening.
There are other guest stars in that book that were not solicited, so we'll keep that a surprise for a bit. But also, back to issue 1, the board vote is happening real soon.
Yeah, like imminently.
Tony is not going to have much time to stop this from happening. Then we get to our final page of the issue. I did this specifically because my wife loves the first Iron Man. I love the first Iron Man movie, but like my wife really loves it and is constantly yelling out whenever I fuck something up, Tony Stark built this, you know, in a cave with a box of scraps. So shout out to my wife.
But you wanted to evoke that 60s origin moment of him doing it in darkness by himself.
Exactly. That like facing the prospect of his resources being imminently stripped from him, he must rely on his resourcefulness. He's designing an armor basically right as he gets out of traction, which means he was designing it like in his head in the moment.
In the hospital bed. Yeah, he was already thinking
about
it.
Okay, how do I build an Iron Man now that all of these suits are compromised?
Well, because the thing about Tony Stark that I think sets him apart from other super scientist characters like Reed or Hank Pym or Beast is he has like a MacGyver thing to him.
Yeah.
Like they're more lab scientists, and Tony
The
kind of guy who's going to like jury rig something together to get himself out of this shit.
Tony is applied science, right?
Yeah.
He's also making stuff so he can sell it in certain contexts. I think it's very important to, and this is why we go to a factory in the beginning of the episode, Tony Stark is in the business of making stuff. He's an inventor. He's a fabricator. He likes doing this stuff himself. He likes welding. There are so many classic shots of Iron Man welding, like so much so that it's like an MCU trope even.
It definitely evokes the MCU version, but the MCU version was evoking directly comics that existed already. You know, like this is the way that I would say that if you think back to the 60s origin, it's like the Fantastic Four and the Cosmic Rays, or like the X-Men fighting Magneto at the naval base. This is the image I think of too when I think of like Silver Age Iron Man.
Yeah, we're ending issue one real, real low for our hero. Stakes as high as they could be. We will learn that we don't yet know just how high those stakes are. We're going to find that out in issue three. But it was important. This is also a moment where, like, I have Justine kind of, like, turn to the camera and say, like, this isn't an armor war.
Yes.
Once we introduce Ironmonger and a Hammer legacy.
You want to be clear that you're not just playing the hits. You've got something else like, going on.
This is not Armor Wars 3. We actually had, Sarah and I had, like, a discussion about this in which we explicitly had to address, like, if we go down a certain direction, which we decided not to go down, if we went too far down that way, we would be doing Armor Wars 3, and we don't want to do that. We are not playing the hits. I love a lot of this stuff, but I don't want to sit in karaoke.
Right. You want to write original songs.
Yeah. We're about to do that. We're going back to an armor design. You know, we see it on the cover here by Yasmin Putri on cover A, which is just absolutely gorgeous.
Beautiful cover.
Right before we get to it, because we introduce it on the credits page, we will see it in action starting in issue 2. What Tony is building is a desperation armor, a vulnerability armor. We're going to be iterating on this, but this is a down and out armor of a kind that we are probably not used to seeing Iron Man wear since the Mark One. We're back in this mode, except the stakes are not what the stakes are in Iron Man's origin story. That was sort of the last moment where I wanted to showcase in issue one, Iron Man legacy. Here we also learn on the credits page, Tony is thinking about his next move, not just as Iron Man, but as Tony Stark. One of the ways that we've got in the book a discussion of how this merger is inevitable by the people who have designed it and who are implementing it is that these corporations are incredibly cash flush. They've got a tremendous amount of access to capital. And now here we have Iron Man saying for the final caption, this truly is not an armor war. He is going to attack their wealth. And that is going to be what kicks off. And now we go to the spread. My cold open, the Stark rocks on war. I really wanted to end with the credits spread because I love a cold open and I love a double page spread credits page. To have the first issue be the cold open, I thought was the move.
Yeah, no, I mean, because it's not something you can do every single time, but if you're going to do a cold open, do it at the open, right?
Yeah, exactly. That is Capital Strike, our first part of the Stark Rocks on War.
X-Men.
And now, Celine, with a message from our sponsors. Hark! Saturnalia fast approaches, and if you want to hear your loved one shriek with delight this holiday season, Uncommon Goods is your secret weapon. They've scoured the globe for the most remarkable and truly unique tributes for everyone on your list. Whether you're shopping for your hereditary high priest or your apprentice in dark sorcery, Uncommon Goods knows exactly what they want and has found just the independent artisans and small businesses to create it. Personally, I'm looking at astrologer Brianna DeVito's personalized birth chart book, because surely the stars can somehow explain this granddaughter I wound up with, and a cute dirty martini ornament by artist Meg Morehouse for the Hellfire Club Christmas tree. These fine products are often made in small batches, so shop now before it's too late. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a non-profit partner of your choice. They've already donated more than $2.5 million to charity. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/cerebro. That's uncommongoods.com/cerebro for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. because we're all out of the ordinary.
X-Men, X-Men.
What would you like to say to the Iron Man fans out there about your run, what they should look forward to, what's going to be different and exciting about it, what you hope they will take away from this issue and the ones to come?
I am trying to put Iron Man into circumstance that on some level is familiar with his character history, so that it is not going to be too jarring when we pair that with circumstances that he usually doesn't mess with at all and do not play to his strengths. We're going to be doing that not just in this arc, but in every arc. The way I want to approach writing Iron Man, because as we've been talking about, the way you go about challenging Tony Stark is by scale. I imagine myself in a bath with the water between my upper lip and my nostrils. Tony's got to be on his tiptoes to not drown because of everything we're throwing at him. I'm a journalist. The part of your piece that's, as we call it in the business, the lead through the nut graph, which is the parts of the story that tell you what's happening, who's involved, and why you should care. All of that lead to nut graph stuff is a check that the rest of the story has to cash. So we're telling you right here, this is what we're going to be doing, and then everything else cashes it out. You will see across the run how practically every page of this first issue will do that for everything that comes next, whether it is through foreshadowing or misdirection. This first issue is dense with clues and hints and seeding for what we're going to manifest and harvest throughout the rest of Iron Man. And it's going to be very, very big. Let me say it like this. When I did my Waller versus Wildstorm miniseries for DC, my editor and now friend, Chris Conroy, who's an absolutely brilliant editor.
So great.
Said, we could maybe do this in continuity, but you have a choice. You can do this kind of on its own, as its own thing, so that it doesn't interact or need to interact with the rest of the DCU. I chose that one because then I could kind of make up my own mashup DC Wildstorm, Earth, whatever. Here, when Sarah and I were first talking about this book and this pitch, she was like, there might be notes that we'll have to hit that like reference other stuff happening in the Marvel Universe, but you can do this in such a way that like it's kind of your book doing its own thing. And I said, absolutely not. I think the fun of a book like Iron Man is that it plays with the rest of the Marvel Universe, that it reflects what the status quo is in the Marvel Universe at that time, and that it can present what Iron Man does maybe in Avengers, in other books, his book would be able to give a different perspective on more of his interiority, more of his motivations, more of his machinations that will not be visible necessarily to the rest of the Marvel Universe. I believe in this story, and I believe in this team. When you look at what Julius is drawing, not just how exquisite his figure work is, but I would encourage you to go through the book. Don't read anything that's in captions and balloons, and just watch as he tells this story, because it's incredible. And the heads know, and he certainly needs no introduction. Alex Sinclair is one of the greatest colorists to ever work in this medium. And every panel, every page, looks so beautiful and so vibrant. I like looking at this book scene by scene.
I was pretty floored by how pretty this issue is. I gotta be real.
It's so gorgeous.
Like, wow, this is pretty to look at.
Go through it scene by scene. Take a breather after each scene. Just watch how Alex does different palettes throughout the scenes. And it's so good. I hope you like it. I will also say to fans of Cerebro and people who come here knowing that it is not an Avengers podcast, there will be things for X-Men fans. There will be reasons that if you jumped on to Iron Man with Jerry's run, I will give you reasons to stay. This is not an X-Men book. This is an Avengers Office book. But there will be stuff. There will be things here for X-Men people as soon as issue 2.
Well, Spencer, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to chat about this issue, because honestly, if nothing else, this is such a historic moment for you, and I'm glad to get it on tape.
Well, thank you so much, Connor. This is also happening because you hosted me on Cerebro. I had more than one person come up to me at New York Comic Con to meet me and to check out the book who don't know my journalism. They know me from Cerebro. So I want to thank you for that.
Well, that's my pleasure. I am frankly just lucky that I met you through this show and that you enjoy doing the show enough to have been on it a whole bunch of times. So, hey, a rising tide, right?
A rising tide right back at you, pal.
You can follow Cerebro on Instagram at CerebroCast. You can follow me on Instagram at Connor Goldsmith. You can find all of the episodes plus links to the merch store, the Discord server, and much, much more at CerebroCast.com, the official landing page for the podcast. For just $5 a month at the House of Zaladin tier at Patreon.com/CerebroCast, you can get exclusive access to the secret files, bonus episodes you won't get anywhere else, including the Krakoa Revisited series that Holly Raymond and I will be launching soon, where we are going back over every character I've already covered in the show and analyzing their full 5-year Krakoan arc. The upcoming Val Cooper Power Hour, a breakdown and analysis of season 1 of X-Men 97. Lots more coming down the pipe on the Patreon. Spencer, where can they follow you and your work?
I am Attackerman on Instagram and sometimes rarely or more rarely Blue Sky. You can subscribe to my journalism newsletter, Forever Wars, at forever-wars.com. This is going to have some Iron Man behind the scenes, but I'm going to paywall that stuff. So please buy a subscription if that's what you're coming to this for, but I will make it worth your while. I'm a columnist for Mehdi Hassan's publication, Zateo. You can find my column there monthly. And also monthly is Iron Man.
Yeah.
From Marvel Comics. You can also read a book I wrote about the war on terror called Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump, that won a 2022 American Book Award.
Sure did.
So it might be a pretty interesting book that you might want to check out.
It's a pretty good book. Hopefully it won't be super relevant again in a week.
Yeah, really.
Sorry, I was trying.
No, it's true.
Honest,
I mean, no,
but like, I mean,
you're right. Yeah, I mean,
and when you're right, you're right. No, it's like, well, we'll see.
We'll see how that impacts my
vote, kids. If you hear this, vote. I'm not going to pull that. It doesn't matter who you vote. No, vote for Kamala Harris. Thank you. That's the official Cerebro endorsement. Election Day horrors aside, this has been a great respite from my low grade anxiety. That's just like an 8.
We're full circle because when we first did the Beast episode,
it was literally, we were waiting. Weren't we waiting to hear when he did it? Because it was in that weird window.
I feel like this was like during the window where Georgia had not come in yet.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is happening again, Twin Peaks giant voice, because like that's going to be us in like 3, because it's going to take days.
Yes, it is.
Oh, God. All right. Well, go buy Iron Man. It was good. Look, I mean, like, I loved it. I really did. I was annoyed at Jerry for making me read Iron Man every month. And now I'm extra annoyed because I'm still reading Iron Man every month. And it's not even X-Men related anymore. But I'm going to do it anyway, because you're good. You're good at what you do, Spence.
Thank you, Connor.
Thank you, as always, for listening. And until next time, bye. X-Men.
Iron Man.
They must have had something in that 90s cartoon.
I bet you could find it and it would be really funny.
I bet I could find it.
But don't like drive yourself.
I'm not going to knock myself out.
Yeah.